from the Hill Country in Texas, broadcasting worldwide, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Here's your host, Patrick Timpone.
Well, good morning, all. It's the 1st of November. Did we go trick-or-treating last night? No. After doing that show on global warming not yesterday, I was going to go as dress up like Al Gore, you know, and just go around the neighborhood, but everybody turned their lights off at 6, so I didn't go. Turn them on. Well, it's as I said, 1st of November, and this is OneRadioNetwork.com. My name is Patrick Timpone. Every Wednesday, we talk with currency historian, nationally recognized one at that. He's couple books, Secret World of Money and Uncle Sam Cooks the Books, working on a third monetary history of the United States. And we talk about money and how it's created and who does the creation and the intertwining of geopolitics and money and how it ties into you and how you might be able to have enough money so you don't outlive your money. Listening to One Radio Network the rest of the week when we talk about your health will keep you going for a long time, and you have to have some money to buy food and stuff like that and make the house payments and whatever. So we try to do it all here. Andrew Goss is here. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Patrick.
What are you doing there, kid? What are you doing?
Hey, you know, Pouring over documents.
well, yeah. I was about to say that Andrew Goss is also, he'll never say it, but I think he's one of the foremost scholars on the JFK assassination. He's probably read every book and took classes and been studying it for, what, Andy, 35, 40 years or so, a long time?
Yeah, at least that long.
Long time.
Yeah.
So we thought we would do a bit on the JFK assassination stuff because 27,000, that's a lot, 27,000 files, or 28,000 rather,
yeah,
files out of the 33, President Trump said that they're going to release the other 5 real soon. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, that's my understanding. Uh-huh. Yeah, but it was my understanding that they would all be released on Thursday.
Yeah, there was so. 5 they didn't want to do.
You mean 5 files? A lot more than
5,000.
About 5,000.
So I haven't seen a lot yet, but you probably have better resources than I. Have you seen much of anything of the 28,000 that would take some of the conspiracy theory, quote, stuff into more of the factual stuff?
Well, I would say that anyone who is paying attention at this point, who will spout the party line, which is that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, the lone nut theory, really is bending the truth, because it's evident by now. And remember, the House Assassination Committee hearings in 75 saw a lot of this stuff. They did.
Yes,
they saw a lot.
The Church Committee.
Yes. And so they know. I mean, they know what was in there. And certainly the idea that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone should be pretty much put to bed with this release of documents.
Uh-huh. I saw a survey a couple months ago. I think 75% of Americans believe that the single bullet or single shooter theory was incorrect.
That's right. And one of the things that was released was a memo. Now, on Friday, on last Wednesday, forgive me, we read the Nicholas Katzenbach memo, right?
Yes.
Americans must be convinced and so forth that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. So now among this release was a J. Edgar Hoover memo, which essentially says the same thing. He says, quote, The thing I am concerned about, and this was on November 24th,
ooh,
2 days later.
Right.
The thing that I am most concerned about, and so is Katzenbach, is having something issued so that we can convince the public that Oswald is the real assassin.
Jedgar said that?
Jedgar said in a memo, and then he ended it with, "There's nothing further on the Oswald case except that he is dead."
And this is 2 days after.
Yes.
And yes, he was ready to close the books, right?
Yeah.
This is the head of the FBI.
The head of the FBI. And the thing I'm concerned about, and wow, so is Katzenbach, is having something issued so that we can convince the public that Oswald is the real assassin.
Wow.
What a choice of words.
Wow. Is the real assassin.
That's right.
And who did he write that to?
It's an internal memo to his FBI agents. Mm-hmm. So. Well,
and refresh our memory, who Katzenbach people did
Nicholas Katzenbach
last year, last week rather,
Deputy Attorney General, who wrote that famous Katzenbach memo, which has been public since 75. So that was one of the first things I saw that convinced me that folks inside the government were really eager, long before the Warren Commission was enacted, long before the investigation was complete, they were eager to prove to the American public that Oswald was the assassin and that he acted alone. And then, of course, the origins of Oswald, right? Long rumored to be part of the apparatus there, the intelligence apparatus, either DIA or CIA or even FBI. And I think, again, these documents pretty much confirm that he was no stranger to the FBI.
Or the CIA.
Right? Or the CIA. Yeah, they knew long of him. They have a very thick intelligence file on Lee Harvey Oswald. So the idea that he was just some unknown lone nut that popped up out of nowhere and killed the president, that's completely put to rest.
Yeah.
He was well known, well connected, and under surveillance by the FBI.
Also, I read some documents where it substantiates the contentions of the JFK people over the years, like you, the connection between Ruby and Oswald.
Oh, I found a great Ruby thing.
Did you?
Oh, wait, yeah, I had to print this one. Hold
okay.
On.
Andrew Goss, if you'd like to join the show, 888-663-6386, email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. It is November 1st, 2017. Join the show if you'd like.
So, this FBI document of 24th November 1947. How about that, huh?
1947?
Yes.
What?
Well, the Kefauver Committee, the House Committee on Un-American Activities, remember?
Yeah, well,
and you know who was leading that thing up, right?
Nixon. Nope.
That's right. So, he listened to this memo. First of all, it was marked eyes only, top secret.
Top secret.
"It is my sworn statement that one Jack Rubenstein of Chicago, noted as a potential witness for hearings of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, is performing important functions for the staff of Congressman Richard Nixon. It is requested Rubenstein not be called for open testimony in these aforementioned hearings."
Okay, tell us what that, I don't get that. I mean, I don't understand what that is. It sounds great, but I don't
Okay, it's the staff assistant to Richard Nixon writing a letter to the FBI, the Department of Justice, requesting that Jack Ruby be excused from testifying before the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Hmm.
Nixon.
Yeah, what's the motive there?
Nixon getting Jack Ruby to not testify?
Yeah. I mean,
well, never mind the motive.
No, you said 47. This is not right.
1947. He was being called. I'm showing, this memo shows that Jack Ruby, and I found another one in which Sam Giancana mentions that Nixon got Ruby out of testifying before the House Un-American Activities Committee. So
Nixon and Ruby.
Nixon knew Ruby. In 47.
That's 70 years ago.
That's correct.
Wow.
That's correct. Whoa. Ruby had no connections to Oswald, remember? Remember the Warren Commission said Ruby had no connections to Oswald.
Wow.
But yet Jack Ruby of Chicago right here being released from his testimony before the House Un-American Activities Committee, is performing important functions for the staff of Congressman Richard Nixon. So the ties between Nixon and Ruby predate the assassination by some 15 years.
Yeah, at least.
Yeah.
Right?
Almost 20. Yeah, almost 20.
Wow. Wow. That's pretty cool.
A smoking gun for you. And then here we go. This one, Lyndon Johnson, who of course, well, I guess maybe we should do the Russians first. So the Russians were panicked beyond belief that they were going to be blamed for all of this.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, didn't Oswald have some Russian connection with KGB in Mexico City and all that?
Well, they deny all, the KGB. Now, a KGB agent named Kosenko defected years later, and he pretty much laid the record bare, which, by the way, is part of the stuff that hasn't been released. What this Soviet agent, Nosenko, who was a KGB agent, well-known, he pointed the finger squarely at Johnson and said that the Russian government believed that Johnson engaged with a cabal to kill the president. So the Russians believed as early as 1965, after their thorough investigation, that the entire thing was fomented and orchestrated by the president of the United States, Lyndon Baines Johnson.
Okay, I did a dumb thing, and I just figured out that the live streaming wasn't started. So,
okay.
So I want to go back and just go, this will be on tape, but this will be worth repeating. Sorry about that, folks. You know, it was just one of those mornings. I was doing different things with this Kennedy stuff. So repeat what you said about the Nixon-Ruby connection. Good morning to all of you who are listening live. Sorry.
Good morning to any who just popped in.
It was a fat finger thing. I had a fat head this morning. I didn't have any coffee, and it's my fault. Okay. So tell folks, so in 1947,
in these documents, I found a memo from the staff of Richard Nixon asking that Jack Ruby be excused from testifying before the House Un-American Activities Committee. And it proves two things. Mm-hmm. One, that Jack Ruby was involved enough in 1947 to be called to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee, and that Richard Nixon knew him well enough to get him excused from these proceedings.
So Richard M. Nixon had to have known Ruby
in 1947,
16, 17 years before the Kennedy assassination.
Correct. And the connections between, you remember Nixon's good friend, B.B. Rebozo.
B.B., yeah, down in Florida, right?
Yes.
Down in Florida.
Yes.
He had a big yacht. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And his connections to the Traficantes of the world is so well documented that this was, in effect, Richard Nixon's mob connection.
Oh, okay. B.B. Rebozo and Traficante.
Yeah.
And then, so then that's the mob connection to the assassination.
Correct. And the record, by the way, is absolutely chock full of references to activities that the CIA would have to be embarrassed by, Operation Mongoose, plots to assassinate Fidel, and tying the mob together with that. Now, you remember we discussed on previous shows, or maybe you don't remember, I'll refresh. Meyer Lansky provided critical support to the U.S. allies during the invasion of Sicily. So in World War II, when we were going to land our boys on the beaches of not Normandy, not France, but the Italian invasion the year before, that we, members of our government, CIA, FBI, approached the mob and said, hey, we'd really like your help in making sure that the people don't attack American troops as they land in Italy.
Oh, good.
And as proven, this is not a disputed fact at all, the mob assisted,
the
mafia, which, by the way, it was Nixon that made his people stop calling them the mafia.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah. Mafia.
He ordered the Justice Department. You remember, this was in a period now. Robert Kennedy, JFK's brother, had been pursuing with great gusto the organized crime in America.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness! Yeah. Like, well, one of the things that made his life so difficult, JFK, I'm referring to here, is the fact that his father, Joe Kennedy, also mobbed up, closely connected, had promised those folks that, oh, he's going to be your president. He'll back off. He'll be good. Don't you worry. If he gets in, you won't have to worry anymore. They felt betrayed. Hmm.
Andrew Goss, and we're going over some of the Kennedy files. Andrew's been studying the JFK assassination for many, many, many years. Probably read, how many books do you think you read on this thing?
I was digging the shelf last night in preparation for the show, and I have 68 books on the Kennedy assassination.
60. How many do you think have been written? Probably 100.
Oh, more. Hell, hundreds, yeah.
Really? So if you'd like to join the show, 888-663-6386, email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Quite a lot of things are going on in the money world, pension funds and stuff, and we'll get into it later on, but we're going to cover out of this because you asked for it. So did these new release files last week come up with anything? I believe you said that J. Edgar Hoover had made a pretty startling statement on record in these new files about Oswald.
Yes, I had already, last show we talked about the Nicholas Katzenbach memo. Nicholas Katzenbach, the Deputy Attorney General, right, had written a memo to his underling saying the public must be convinced that Oswald was the lone assassin. And it was pretty bad. You know, it was 2 days after the
assassination.
Right. So, but it was along the lines of, and I quoted it verbatim last week, where he's just telling his people, we have to convince the public that Oswald was the guy and that he did it alone.
Right.
And then this time there's a memo released that's in J. Edgar Hoover's file, and he wrote, quote, "The thing I am concerned about, and so is Katzenbach, is having something issued so that we can convince the public that Oswald is the real assassin."
J. Edgar Hoover.
"There is nothing further on the Oswald case except that he is dead."
2 days after the assassination.
Yes, yes, yes.
Can you imagine the head of the FBI saying that 2 days after the assassination?
And that's why Mark Lane, his famous book, Rush to Judgment.
Rush to Judgment, right.
That's what that, you know, and Mark Lane being very close to the folks of Texas, well, who would know, right? You would think he would know. What goes on in Texas. And so he was the one that that really started it all with Rush to Judgment.
Are you familiar with, I found one doc, I don't, there's no way you could go through 27,000, but are you familiar with somebody by the name of P-E-N-T, I can't read, it's kind of smeared, you know, these old documents. 1964.
You're talking about Potito?
Yeah, Potito.
Yeah, the Potito memo.
Yeah, it's St. Petersburg, Florida. Very curious, where he says, in the Surgeon General's report on the assassination stated that the first bullet entered the president's throat below the Adam's apple,
right,
clearly showing two persons were involved, with the first shot being fired from the bridge across the parkway in front of the car to further substantiate this. Potito said there was a bullet hole in the windshield. And when the windshield thing is a fascinating story itself, the bullet hole in the windshield.
The men who killed Kennedy.
The men who killed Kennedy, right. But so, and we can see it in the Zapruder film.
That's right.
I mean, the shot in the
throat,
right?
And you can see it in photographs, and we have the testimony of the people that changed the windshield, and, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's stay with the shot for a minute. Windshield, okay, we'll get to, because that's huge, right? That's
yeah,
a big deal.
Huge. It is.
But just
deal.
The throat shot, wasn't there all kinds of witnesses that stated that it came from over there?
Of course.
I mean, just lots.
Yeah.
Now, were those released, those documents?
Those are long since released.
Oh, they really?
Oh, goodness, yeah. Nigel Ferguson, in his series, The Men Who Killed Kennedy.
Right.
Episode 7, called The Smoking Gun.
Good title.
Actually went to great lengths, found the people that changed the windshield, you know, found pictures of the original windshield with the bullet hole, clearly from the outside fired in, not from the inside fired out. And, you know, testimony from those folks that suggest that the windshield in the possession of the National Archives and now on display is not the same windshield that was in the vehicle when they received it.
So I didn't get... So the windshield was the shot that hit him in the throat?
No.
Oh, okay. I didn't think so. Okay.
The windshield merely showed that there was fire coming from places other.
Right.
Then remember, this is what caused the famous Arlen Specter, who later became a senator with the help of those whom he helped to protect. He was the one that came up with the idea of the magic bullet theory because, and I'm a pragmatist. I don't believe in magic bullets. And I don't believe in conspiracy theories. So his concept, and again, this is Arlen Specter, was that that one bullet made all the zigzags and hit both Connolly, shattered his wrist, went through him, hit the president, and so forth.
The Oliver Stone film.
Right, the magic bullet. And the reason they needed that magic bullet is because all the other shots were accounted for.
Oh, the other two, supposedly that he fired three.
Right, but meanwhile, you had James Teague, who was under that overpass you're talking about, was hit by a ricochet that struck the ground. So the Dealey Plaza triangulation site was a hail of gunfire, as described by the people who dove for cover on the other side of the limousine. Like if you're, there were too many shots. And because there were too many bullets that they found, then they had only left one to have done all this damage. And so this is where the magic bullet theory originated. And now this windshield evidence,
And I saw documents this morning. There's 6 or 7 or 8 different people testified,
to the Warren Commission.
To the Warren Commission there was a windshield.
That's right.
They saw it. Right at Parkland Hospital, they saw
it. That's right.
And then they switched it out.
Yeah, no, they switched it out twice.
Twice.
They switched it once.
The government did.
Put in the new one.
Yeah.
I'm using my air quotes. Yeah. The new one. They took out the original, put in a dummy, and then damaged the dummy.
Oh, so when this whole windshield shot thing came up, they'd say, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was damaged, but, that was from some fragment from the inside of the car.
I see.
And so now they send the damaged windshield, which is like every other good cover-up. Those CSI guys can tell which side of the glass the bullet was hit on and so forth. Yeah, right? But in 1963, we didn't think of all that CSI stuff. About the best thing we had were fingerprints. And so they took out that windshield and put in the third windshield. They took out the second one that was damaged to look like it had been engaged in this. And then they sent it to Detroit to have a new windshield put in of a different kind of glass, PPG's bulletproof glass. That by itself suggests, wait a minute. And additionally, that car was driven from the, they put it back on the plane, flew it back to Washington, and somebody had to drive it from Andrews, Joint Base Andrews now, back to the White House garage. And those two people that drove it were Secret Service agents, and the Secret Service agent that was allegedly, you would have to think, was in the passenger seat, and this was one of the questions the Warren Commission didn't ask, which was, where did you sit when you were riding from the airport back to the White House garage? Now, it's incredulous to me to believe that that second Secret Service agent, because one was driving, that the second Secret Service agent would sit anywhere other than the front passenger seat.
Were these the two that the FBI came back and said, you can't say that, otherwise we're going to...
That's correct.
Tell them that story. That's
well,
crazy.
Essentially, the second FBI agent described the bullet hole in the Secret Service, forgive me,
in
not
the
FBI.
Windshield, right?
The Secret Service agent described the bullet hole in the windshield on the lower right corner of the windshield, right in front of where he was sitting in the passenger seat.
Right.
And the Warren Commission investigators told them, no, you can't say that.
Because we'll charge you with perjury if you say that.
You can't say that.
Whoa. Boy, that's spooky, isn't it? When they tell you, you're going to charge you with perjury for telling the truth.
That's right.
Then you know something's rotten in Denmark.
Yes, that's right. And a great many people did.
Andrew Goss, Patrick Timpone. It is The Real World of Money, doing a little special kind of recap of what Andy's been able to see thus far in these files. We'll see about the other 5,000 files. So Andrew Goss, I guess if there must be something pretty good in these other 5,000,
Maybe.
Do you think the United States got the cojones, so to speak, to release some really...
No.
Really
smoking...
That's what I
said. No,
probably
I remember
not.
You asked
They're just
me.
Not going to do that.
That question was asked and answered,
They're
right?
just not going to do it.
No way they can. And to me, the three tramps, Frank Sturgis, E. Howard Hunt, Richard Nixon, and the Morales fella, you know, those three guys that were apprehended there. And I mean, they even have Dallas police the day before the assassination, like any good, well-planned operation, they met on the other side of the fence at the grassy knoll. And Lee Bowers, who was the railroad man up in the tower there that was responsible for switching the trains as they came up, called the police and said, hey, there's some guys over here with rifles trying to, who knows what they're doing. But there's some guys with rifles in the rail yard looking out into Dealey Plaza.
Oh, good.
And so the police dispatched some officers there to check it out. And by the time they got there, the guys were gone. But the report is, again, part of these released records.
Mm.
So the idea that they were casing Dealey Plaza is now recorded and memorialized, right?
Yeah.
And so then there's the second piece of that, which is what got Mark Lane on the subject, was the three tramps. You've heard the three tramps. We've talked about the three tramps before. These were three well-dressed men who were described as hobos. I guess I say well-dressed, but they weren't. Like in suits.
They're clean old clothes.
They were clean old clothes, right. But their shoes told it all. You know, a hobo's going to wear shoes that are duct taped, but these guys had on, you know, nice leather loafers. And so anyway, they were photographed going in and out of the police, what the police call a perp walk. So minutes after the assassination, they had arrested these three people in Dealey Plaza.
And who are they?
And, well, they were Frank Sturgis, E. Howard Hunt,
Oops.
And a third captain of the Army 57, I believe was the name.
Two of them were Watergate boogers, right?
Yeah.
Watergate boogers.
And Howard Hunt is saying that he's quoted, of course, his son, St. John Hunt.
On his deathbed, right?
On his deathbed, yeah. He gave a full confession. And it's been, you know, recorded and written. So he didn't go to his grave taking the secrets with him. And he said clearly that he thought at any minute, this was Gordon Liddy.
Gordon Liddy's still around.
Gordon Liddy said at any moment he was ready to kill Howard Hunt if they asked him to. And that he himself was willing to be assassinated. He said, I'll just go on a corner. You can have somebody shoot me. And that'll be that.
Wow.
So here's a guy who's in the game, you know, full skin, if you will, Gordon Liddy.
Andrew Goss, Patrick Timpone, if you'd like to join the show, 888-663-6386, email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. We are moving a few of these far infrared saunas. Got kind of a special deal if you'd like to get the Relax Far Infrared Sauna, and we'll give you a $250 value far infrared lamp. I have one. Phil sent me one last week, and they're really cool. I've been playing with it almost every night. You can put this little pumpkin on your tummy, on sore spots, put it on your thyroid, put it on your liver, and it's a full spectrum far infrared with a little heat lamp. You can hold it. It's really cool. Put it on your kidneys. I mean, just anywhere. Guys, you could put it on your prostate if you got some things going on there. Very, very powerful. So if you'd like to get a deal on the sauna and the lamp, email me, patrick@oneradionetwork.com, or if you'd just like to get the lamp, I'll give you a deal. And these days, I have a little leeway here with this sauna price, but we can't put it in print, and so that's what Phil has given me. So I got a little leeway, so the way we're going to do it from now on with the sauna is when you want to buy one, just to email me, and we'll work out a deal. How's that? patrick@oneradionetwork.com. We're with Daniel Vitalis of Sir Thrival. New product, taboo. Can I guess what that's about?
Yeah, taboo is our first aphrodisiac elixir. I like to think of it as a chocolate liqueur. Not only rich in chocolate and vanilla and maple, but all of these different herbs which help seduce the senses and help to plump up erectile tissue in the body. There are standardized extracts of epimedium. You've probably heard of that, called horny goatweed. And then ashwagandha as well. But there's also morapuama, tribulus, maca, and a good dose of elk antler in there as well. Now, the idea is that it works in the short term to enhance libido and enhance the engorgement of erectile tissue, both in men and women. But it also works long term, optimizing your sex hormones to increase libido in the long game as well.
Well, that sounds fun, doesn't it? Why not get one for her and one for him? And all Sir Thrival products are on sale. And of course, this new one, Taboo, as well, 10% off right now through November 7th. Click and order. Use promo code ONERADIO. On sale, all Sir Thrival products on OneRadioNetwork.com.
My friend was down in Los Angeles recently, and he brought up some pure sulfur.
We just ordered some from you.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I was just looking at it, and I was like, wow, you know, this stuff really is totally different. So I put a tablespoon in my mouth and just chugged it with water, and wow.
Yeah, thanks. A lot of people get that wow thing. I felt something first time I took it about 3 years ago, and we've been promoting this pure organic sulfur ever since. 2-pound orders, 3 different prices, United States, Canada, worldwide, and you can click an order right now on the front page right here, OneRadioNetwork.com.
Broadcasting live, weekday mornings, this is listener-supported One Radio Network. Good morning, this is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com.
Every Wednesday, we have a couple hours or so of The Real World of Money with Andrew Goss, a currency historian and author, working on his third book. And today, a little special thing before we get into the money, to tie whatever loose ends we can with these Kennedy files that were released last week, 28,000 of them. President says 5,000 more are coming. You know, I was reading some of these files about the church committee in 75.
Right, and that's what started it all.
Yeah, and some of the things that they have documented that the CIA were involved in, like, let's see, Lumumba, a Congo, DM of South Vietnam, Trujillo.
Yeah, let's stay with that one, DM. Yeah,
they kill these people.
Okay, so the CIA initiated a coup against the Vietnamese president, DM. And
wow.
They assassinated him and his brother. Very famous scene from the Green Beret.
Coup d'etat, right?
Just boom. Yeah, they took the president, vice president, kidnapped them and rendered them, as they say, and then killed them, assassinated them. And Lyndon Johnson, in fact, Richard Helms, a CIA director, there was a testimony from him in which he said, quote, President Johnson used to go around saying that the reason President Kennedy was assassinated was that he had assassinated President Diem.
Ooh.
And see, all of this was planned not by Kennedy, but by, you know who?
Nixon.
Richard Nixon, right. Eisenhower's vice president. He's the one that was the chief architect behind the Bay of Pigs, Operation Mongoose, and all of the anti-Castro stuff that was hatched during the Eisenhower years, the late Eisenhower years, and Kennedy effectively inherited. So when Kennedy became president, he inherited this plan to invade Cuba.
Yeah,
With these Army 57, these Cuban refugees that were training in Lake Pontchartrain in the Louisiana swampland, and there made contact with
Richard Ferry.
Well, David Ferry, close enough.
David Ferry.
Who was buddies with Lee Harvey Oswald from their days in the Civil Air Patrol.
You just can't even make this stuff up.
That's right. So the connections between all of these people and Clay Bertrand, Clay Shaw,
Clay Shaw
of New Orleans, who was the paymaster who, you know, got these guys together, got them the guns, got them a training camp, Lake Pontchartrain, and basically oversaw the entire operation. And Jim Garrison, the district attorney of New Orleans, right, he was on them. He had them.
Clayshaw was found innocent, though, right?
Well, of course he was, after the disinformation campaign that was launched against during the trial. CBS News ran an expose on what a lowlife Jim Garrison was.
Surprise.
Yeah, surprise.
Fake news back then, huh?
Yeah, and so the movie JFK goes into it fairly well. He and his wife, in the movie played by Sissy Spacek, are sitting in bed and turn on the TV, and boom, here's a live report, a special report on what a bum Jim Garrison is. So there was, fake news. Well put. You know, this was at the time when Walter Cronkite was a CIA operative. So America's news, they didn't look at it as fake news, man. That was the news. And the news just said Jim Garrison's a fraud. So totally derailed his entire investigation.
So I guess it's
bugged his office, infiltrated his employees, did everything in their power. And this is CIA, FBI, and DIA to besmirch the reputation of Jim Garrison so that no one would believe anything he said.
So then can we theorize then a fellow like Richard Nixon, this was part of his ascent to the presidency.
Oh, goodness, yes.
Right? I mean, that's how it works.
Oh,
right?
Goodness,
you,
yes.
You start early on and they have to do dumb stuff. And
right.
They get your dues.
And they get a file on you.
They get a file on you, which is what you said Mr. Nixon was trying to retrieve from the Watergate.
That's right.
I mean, that's what he was trying to get, these documents, not some stuff on the DNC.
He didn't care. He was already winning in a landslide. But as he said, and you know, the Nixon tapes in the White House are very, very demonstrative of his motives and everything else. But he would refer to the H.R. Haldeman, you know, he wrote a book, and there's some great stuff out there from his staff about the Watergate years. And they talk about how paranoid Richard Nixon was about E. Howard Hunt, who was brought into the White House by none other than George Bush.
And so Bush, the connection, his job. Right?
Yeah, that's right. So the connections here between Bush, Nixon, and Kennedy and LBJ are just so palpable. You could cut them with a knife. I mean, they're well documented, well known. And then, of course, in that Smoking Guns movie, and that's episode 7. And I found something interesting on episode 7, that when they when they released episode 7, Bill Moyers, you may recall Bill Moyers.
Oh, yeah, Texas, right?
Right, but he was a Kennedy guy.
And he was Johnson's press secretary.
Yes, he was. Mm-hmm. And Jack Valenti.
Oh, good.
Another Kennedy, LBJ guy. Both of them were outraged, and they called the History Channel and said, oh, you can't show this anymore. And they did. They pulled it. You can't see it anymore. They pulled it, yeah. They demanded an inquiry. And this was back in 2004 with the publication of a book, which I found conveniently on my bookshelf, and autographed, I might add, by a gentleman named Barr McClellan.
Oh, boy.
You ever hear that
attorney
name?
Right?
Attorney, yeah.
In Texas.
Barr McClellan. Yeah, attorney in Texas.
Was he LBJ's attorney?
Right there in Austin. Well, no. Not exactly LBJ's attorney. He worked for the Clark Law Firm. I don't know if that's still...
I don't know if it's still around, but Clark was in with LBJ, right?
Mm-hmm. Edward A.
Yeah.
Edward A. Clark. Mm. And what he described in his book, and this is Blood, Money, and Power, How LBJ Killed JFK, by Barr McClellan. And he acted as Johnson's personal attorney, but by virtue of his employment at the Edward A. Clark Law Firm. And Clark, who later, I believe, became the governor of Texas, acted like and told Barr, and, you know, again, he quoted him several times, that, you know, this was the Johnson exercise, and that he was protecting him, and he did. So, and even to this day, the archives there are pretty much sealed at the Clark Law Firm. And he, you know, LBJ was closely tied from his days as speaker to a gentleman named Billy Soul Estes.
Oh boy!
Yeah.
Boy, there was a you talk about what's the word? I mean,
scandal.
Scandal. Yeah. Scandal.
Department of Agriculture.
Man, that was a big one.
Yeah, it was. It was gigantic. And you know, Bobby Kennedy and LBJ, there was what shall we say, no love lost there.
Sure.
And it was clear, at least according to Barr and others that are connected, that Johnson was going to be dumped from the ticket in 64 because younger brother Bobby told JFK, and you know, Attorney General, he would have a reason to know, right? As Attorney General, he said to JFK, listen, Lyndon is involved in some stinky stuff with these Department of Agriculture loans, taking loans against stuff that didn't exist. And he's going to be prosecuted and he's going to be found guilty. And Billy Soul Estes, who was like a clerk, he wasn't even an elected official, but he was a clerk for the Speaker of the House. His connections to it all just kind of scream guilty for LBJ. So apparently, LBJ, if he wasn't successful in his activities, would have been indicted the following year and charged with fraud.
So that's a motive for his involvement with JFK killing, right?
Well, he was involved. There's no question. Well, like any good conspirator, you know, he tried to throw the blame on someone else. So he said that. He said that the reason Kennedy was assassinated was because of his assassination of DM.
Yeah.
And Richard Helms, the director of the CIA, said, I don't know what the heck he was talking about. So.
Isn't there sworn testimony from his girlfriend the night they had a party on the 21st, right?
Yeah.
In Austin.
Right.
With a lot of the boys that were involved
All of them.
Wow. Can you imagine the gall to get together and have a pre-celebration? And he told this lady that after tomorrow, you know.
Yeah, we're not going to be a problem.
Not going to be a problem.
And curiously, there's there's a file in the Rockefeller archives that has 11 men and their checks. So you have 11 men and checks that they wrote for $10,000 each. And those men were Nixon and Hoover and the same crowd, and a couple that are still unnamed, who met in LBJ's drawing room and planned the whole thing and put in the money. Clint Murchison, does that name ring a bell?
He's sure.
A famous Texas oil man.
Texas oil dude.
He hosted a party the night before that everyone was at. Richard Nixon.
Yeah, Nixon was there too.
Yeah, but Nixon, curiously, everyone remembers where they were when Kennedy was assassinated.
Sure.
And so someone asked Richard Nixon on three separate occasions, where was he when Kennedy was assassinated? I'm trying to find that file because I found it most interesting. So I went back to every interview that Nixon gave and found where he gave three different answers of how he found out that Kennedy was shot. One, he says his cabbie took a wrong turn and some housewife came out of the house screaming, and he rolled down the window and asked her what was wrong, and she said the president had been shot. But that doesn't jibe with the photo of Lyndon Johnson sitting in the terminal at the airport.
Nixon you're talking about?
No, I'm sorry. Yeah. Nixon.
Okay,
yes,
Nixon.
Forgive me.
Yeah.
Nixon.
Nixon.
Sitting at the airport with obvious foreknowledge. And then he gives another interview in which he talks about his cabbie turned on the radio, and that's how he heard that Kennedy was assassinated. Meanwhile, he said, quote, the cabbie missed a turn somewhere, and we were off the highway. A woman came out of her house screaming and crying. I rolled down the cab window and asked what was the matter, and she said, John Kennedy had been shot in Dallas. But the API photo shows a glum-looking Nixon, hat in hand, sitting in what appears to be an airline terminal. The caption on the UPI press photo reads, shocked Richard Nixon, the former vice president who lost the presidential election to Kennedy in 1960, is shown Friday after he arrived at Idlewild Airport in New York, which is now LaGuardia, following a flight from Dallas, Texas, where he had been on a business trip. Now, he said to the Warren Commission that he came back that day before Kennedy was assassinated, when in reality it was the next day.
Andrew Goss, Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. There was a doctored or an enhanced tape for better quality of this General LeMay on Air Force One.
Oh, yeah.
As they were flying Kennedy's body, maybe back to Washington.
Yeah.
But I went to the link and somebody had already taken it down. I don't know.
Sure.
Yeah. What was that about? Why was that significant?
Well, only that he speculated as to who or what may have been. But
he didn't like Kennedy.
But
right?
He did not like Kennedy. Why? Yeah. As president, Nixon ordered White House spy chief E. Howard Hunt to forge diplomatic cables to make it look like President Kennedy ordered the murder of South Vietnamese leader Diem.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
And he sent another spy, Anthony Usalowicz, to Chappaquiddick to investigate the Kennedy car wash up there. You know,
sure.
He placed Kennedy under 24-hour-a-day surveillance in an effort, in Nixon's phrase, to catch him with one of his babes.
Hmm.
And Nixon pressed aides to plant a false story linking Senator Kennedy to the 1972 assassination attempt against George Wallace.
Wow, man.
Yes.
It's like a Grisham novel, right?
Mm-mm.
Like House of Cards.
Yes.
Patrick Timpone, Andrew Goss, in the Real World of Money. Andrew's been studying the JFK assassination for many, many years. And I don't. What else? Let me see. I had something. Oh, yeah. So the contention is that this is how you kind of get in, where you have to do some dastardly deed. And then the deep state, the people that kind of put people in, maybe the boys,
right,
CIA
right.
and FBI and all
right,
that,
right.
then they have something on you, right?
Yes, that's
similar,
the only way you get anything.
Now, the story was that, was it George Bush or one that was involved with JFK Jr.?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Well.
Oh, yeah, he says. Really?
Oh, yeah. Well, JFK Jr.
Yeah, with a plane.
Yeah. JFK Jr., yeah. of course, with his publication George.
Yeah.
It was a magazine.
Yeah.
Had decided that he was going to do once and for all a final investigation on his father's death. I mean, who's got more skin in the game than JFK
Jr.?
John,
oh,
yes.
God,
so, you know, he took all of his money and started a magazine called George. You may remember it.
Oh, yeah. I remember
and then George,
it well.
Yeah. yeah, hired some top crack investigative reporters.
Wow.
And they were digging, man. They were going to find something. And I think...
Because he knew the whole thing stunk, right?
Yeah, come he on. Did. And Bobby did. But, you know, the idea that Bobby always said, oh, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it. While privately behind the scenes, man, he was like on fire. And he was convinced that, you know who? LBJ.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, of course, both Bobby and Jack had talked about their disdain for the CIA.
That's right.
Like, what was it?
Going to scatter it to the winds.
Scatter it to the winds.
Yes.
Here's an email from J.R. He says, what does Andrew know about the Zapruder film? I've heard that it
okay.
was doctored. And,
okay.
And so tell folks what it was. There's a lot of young kids listening and nobody
All
knows
right. So
about.
I talk about the 11 people that are in the... in the photo that the Rockefeller Archives contains, and 11 separate files on the 11 men in the photo and 11 checks drawn by these men, pictures
right.
of them, right? And so the idea that this one gentleman, Abraham Zapruder, was a film nut and had just bought a state-of-the-art color camera.
And so this Zapruder film was a scam too?
It wasn't supposed to be what it was.
Okay.
It was supposed to
Sorry,
show
to interrupt.
Something.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, he went out there and took this picture.
Yeah.
Yeah, took this moving film,
mm-hmm.
which was quickly bought up by a gentleman named Luce, L-U-C-E. Where's his file?
Life magazine, right?
Well, not just Life.
Time Life, yeah.
Bought the tape immediately. I mean, dispatched someone to Texas immediately. And paid an enormous amount of money for this film, millions of dollars. and then buried it. And it didn't even see the light of day for...
Yeah. Literally, I mean, just...
Yeah, buried it.
Oh, nobody looked at it or anything?
Nobody saw it. Nobody heard of it.
What was Luce's idea? What was his thing? I mean, what was his motive? Yeah. Who knows, huh?
I don't know what his motive was. I just know he's one of the 11 guys in this
file. Oh, he was one of the 11 dudes in the...
Yeah.
Oh, God. Anyway.
All right. Yeah, yeah. So, anyway. This is all tying Nixon into the Kennedy assassination. Now, I believe George Bush was also involved in there. And then we're talking HW here.
Yeah.
And in this timeline of Nixon's ties, right? If you see his first election in 1946, the election reports show that he was financed by Meyer Lansky, right? And that his campaign manager, a gentleman named Murray Chotnier, had top mafia figures as his legal clients, and he was the attorney to New Orleans mob chief Carlos Marcello.
Wow.
And James Hoffa, Jimmy Hoffa.
Jimmy Hoffa.
So Jimmy Hoffa's lawyer was Nixon's first campaign manager. That was his first House seat in 1946. Then in 47, Nixon gets Jack Ruby excused from testifying. Then in 47, Nixon backs legislation establishing the CIA.
Whoa.
And that's when he meets Howard Hunt. Then the Kefauver Committee learns that Ruby was a syndicate lieutenant who had been sent to Dallas to serve as the liaison for Chicago mobsters. You know who they are? They're headed by Sam Giancana. So that's in 1950. Then in 1950, in November, Nixon makes it to the Senate from California. And in 52, he's elected vice president. Even though they had a scandal then because there was some secret slush fund that was revealed that was, you know, all these same people had contributed. So even in 52, forgive me, Nixon was connected to or tied to publicly the same people that would later be suggested as possibly behind the Kennedy assassination.
And I want to say this to the television audience. Yeah, yes. I made my mistakes.
Yes, he did.
But in all of my years of public life, I have never profited.
Profited. I'm careful to say that.
Public service. I've earned every cent.
That's right.
And in all of my years of public life, I have never obstructed justice. And I think, too, that I can say that in my years of public life, that I welcome this kind of examination because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
Except checkers. Checkers. And I'm not giving them back.
Not giving them back.
That's right. So this is our Richard Nixon. So between 59 and 60, now he's vice president. And he and Howard Hunt put together this CIA plot to kill Castro and to overthrow him. And
eight tries, right?
Eight tries, yeah. And again,
exploding cigars,
everything,
hookers,
poison swimsuit. They even recruited his mistress. I mean, they did everything they could to kill this guy.
They never got him.
But then there's another tie-in, Robert Mayhew.
I don't know that one. That's
wow, it's name. Yeah, it's not new. Hmm. Actually, Mayhew was Howard Hunt's mouthpiece. So I say Howard Hunt, but I meant Howard Hughes.
Oh, Howard Hughes.
Hughes.
You're kidding.
No.
Oh, Howie was involved in this
Howie
thing
was not only involved in this thing, but he funded a great portion of it through Robert
kidding.
Mayhew, who also has CIA ties as well. So, and then, of course, in 61, the Bay of Pigs is launched. And
tell
Nixon,
folks what that was.
That's where about 1,500...
Whatever. Mercenaries,
yeah, 15,
right?
Yeah, we call them mercenaries.
Hired hands.
CIA trained. They do a great depiction of that in the movie JFK,
yeah.
In which David Ferry and Clay Bertrand, and others, Richard Morales, and, of course, the infamous Frank Sturgis, are training these troops in the swamp around New Orleans, Lake Pontchartrain, because that's, you know, like the Bay of Pigs, a swamp. So they're going to invade Cuba, and we're supposed to provide close air support.
The Air Force.
That's right.
Right. And they were going to just kill Castro, right?
They even had fake jets. They had jets, you know, made up to so that they couldn't be tied to the U.S. and so forth.
Wow.
And they were ready to take off. All they needed was the go-ahead from Kennedy, who said, I'm not giving you that air cover. Well, no, it's part of the plan. Well, without it, these 1,500 guys didn't stand a chance against 20,000 Cuban troops. So Bay of Pigs is launched. It's a monumental failure. And everybody blames Kennedy. Nixon blames him. The CIA blames him. The Cuban exile, you know, leaders blame him. If he would have given the air support, they would have succeeded in overthrowing Castro. Kennedy is so mad at the CIA for getting him into this. This is when, April of 61, where he issues that security action memo, in which he planned to essentially put the CIA under the military's control and scatter them to the winds, as he put it. So,
scatter them to the winds.
And that November 61 is when Nixon fires Allen Dulles as CIA, excuse me, Kennedy fires Nixon's pal, Allen Dulles, as CIA chief. So Allen Dulles, of course, fingerprints are all over this. And then in 62, that's where you don't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore. He loses his race as governor of California after somebody realizes, hey, wait a minute, what's this $205,000 loan from Howard Hughes to your brother?
Really?
Hmm.
What did Howard have against JFK? I mean,
who knows? I just know that he loaned a bunch of money to Nixon's brother, and it, you know, blew up in his face in November of 62, and he's lost his race for governor of California. Of course, now November, the year before, Kennedy fired Nixon's Allen Dulles guy, and then in 62-63, he actually goes to dismantle the CIA. And then, of course, the rest is history. In the summer of 63, you have Lee Harvey Oswald and David Ferry. And remember, David Ferry is the guy that was experimenting with the cancer drugs, and that's Dr. Oxner, who was actually...
Oxner Hospital in New Orleans?
Right? Yes, mm-hmm. Dr. Oxner was actually employed by the CIA to develop an injectable or sprayable cancer-causing
for
agent.
Castro.
Yeah, for Castro. And the Mary's Monkey is a great book about Lee Harvey Oswald's girlfriend at the time, who's, even though he was married to Marina, he was carrying on with this young lady who later wrote a book, Lee and Me,
yeah,
which kind of blows that whole story open. Well, David Ferry in the movie JFK is shown talking about, yeah, we got these rats and we're trying to cure cancer here. Well, not cure cancer. They were trying to cause cancer. And that is curiously what Jack Ruby died of, cancer.
So I'm curious what the mainstream media, because I don't do TV here, have you seen anything in the last week? What have they said about the release files? Anything at all? Have they just forgot about
it? Nothing new.
Or they have built
Have you
up...
heard that Paul Manafort was indicted?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
He's indicted, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the news today.
That's it.
Not, there's no Kennedy news.
No.
Other than...
Russian ties with the...
Yeah,
Russian ties with Oswald, right?
Again with the Russian ties. Yeah. Again.
Yeah.
So, I don't know what the media is doing, but they're certainly not reporting on this story. You remember Jimmy Hoffa when he disappeared, right?
Yeah, he's in cement somewhere in Chicago, isn't he?
Or he's in a barrel somewhere. Yeah. He's under a giant stadium, what I heard. He's out here in New Jersey. But anyway, his lawyer is a gentleman named Frank Regano, who wrote a great book on the Kennedy assassination, which is on my bookshelf, and I'll quote him. Frank Regano. This is Frank Regano quoting Jimmy Hoffa, okay? Quote, "Something has to be done. The time has come for your friend and Carlos." Now there, Frank Regano speculates he's talking about Santos Traficante and Carlos Marcello. "To get rid of him. Kill that son of a bitch Kennedy." End quote.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, if you're on a game show and somebody said, well, who's responsible for JFK's, who would, in your opinion, after all you've learned in many, many, many years, would be the main players?
Oh, well, definitely LBJ. Most definitely LBJ knew about it. J. Edgar Hoover knew about it.
CIA
is all over it, no question about it.
Mafia.
Yeah, but see, all of these people were just the mechanism.
Right.
In order for something like this to happen, the true powers that be, what the Church Committee referred to as the shadow government, the true government behind government, the people that tell the government what to do, they're the ones that have to sign off on something like this. And Kennedy's actions against the Federal Reserve are so well documented to me. I mean, I know that he had, in fact, many have suggested, Gerald Posner for one in Case Closed, that Kennedy was actually not friendly with he was friendly with the Federal Reserve and, in fact, wanted to strengthen their power. Everything that I saw that Kennedy did, and that this leads back to that Executive Order 11110. We had, under the Pittman Act, and from the days of 1890, going back to, the McKinley, Garfield days, James Garfield and William McKinley, the other two presidents that were assassinated in the late 19th, early 20th century. So going back to those days, the U.S. Treasury had been purchasing silver on the open market under law and stacking it, coining it into silver dollars and stacking it in the Treasury. So they had issued Treasury notes dated from 1890 to facilitate this. So these silver certificates, if you will, were issued into the marketplace, and piles and piles and piles and bags and millions of silver dollars were sitting in the Treasury. And the money to pay for them had already been absorbed. It was like your piggy bank. You know, you've already accounted for it. This is extra money. So Kennedy ordered, and you know all the great things. He was going to put a man on the moon, you know, Peace Corps, blah, blah, blah. He was really going to help mankind. How was he going to pay for it? Well, the boys at the Federal Reserve were salivating at the prospect. We're going to get to create all these Federal Reserve notes and loan them to the government so that they can do the war in Vietnam and put a man on the moon and do all these wonderful things. Well, Kennedy issued that executive order, 11110, and it, among other things, it said that any silver in the Treasury that isn't already accounted for, they should issue silver certificates against them. So that's what James J. Saxon authorized. Every silver dollar in the U.S. Treasury that wasn't otherwise accounted for, there was a corresponding silver certificate printed, and it was put into circulation as money. So that greatly increased the money supply. Additionally, legislation allowed for $300 million in United States notes, which at that time was a lot of money. And these are just debts, note instruments of the United States. And Kennedy said, you know, go right up to the limit. Issue these United States notes, and that's effectively what he did. He delegated his authority to the Secretary of the Treasury to simply expand the money supply by issuing silver certificates and U.S. notes.
Which is unprecedented because he bypassed the mechanism of the private Federal Reserve monetizing debt, right?
Oh, you bet he did.
I mean, that's what really poked the giant in the eye.
Well, that and the fact that his comptroller of the currency, a gentleman named James J. Saxon,
yeah.
Sort of strengthened the powers of non-Federal Reserve banks. At that time in this country, not every bank was a member of the Federal Reserve. In fact, many of the small-town bankers viewed the Federal Reserve with disdain as essentially a cartel that was trying to take over their industry. And so they had different charters. They didn't have a nationally issued charter issued under the National Bank Act of 1863. What they had were state-issued charters, which allowed them to operate but not be part of the Federal Reserve System. And so James J. Saxon was using his powers as comptroller of the currency to strengthen these non-Federal Reserve banks. He was moving deposits there. He was giving them the authority to underwrite bonds, which was something that the Federal Reserve banks always considered, the owners of the Federal Reserve banks, always considered
their turf, right?
Stay out of this. This is our wheelhouse. And here James Saxon was doing everything he could to allow state chartered banks, non-Federal Reserve banks.
But Andrew, isn't part of the power of these even small state banks. The idea of being able to take your mortgage and monetize it at the Fed.
It is now. We're talking about 1963
now.
Oh,
they didn't do it then?
Those were the days
when... They actually loaned you real money?
Loaned you their money.
Oh, they did.
And then portfolioed your loan. So that if the Bank of Dripping Springs loaned Patrick money in 1963, they would hold Patrick's mortgage on the books of that bank.
Oh, they keep it right there.
And right there. And it was that banker who contacted you and was concerned when you were in trouble and so forth.
But I didn't think they could loan other depositors' money to people.
Indeed they could take depositors' money.
But not today.
Through sleight of hand, the depositors' money became their money. So, you know, at law, they weren't loaning the depositors' money, meaning they couldn't put the depositor on the hook. You couldn't say, oh, well, that was your money I loaned to
Joe.
And Joe lost it, so I can't pay you back. That is what the law prohibited, for them to say that the money that I'm giving to Joe
is Patrick's.
Right. No, they couldn't say that. They had to say that's the bank's money. So Patrick was not involved in the event of a loss. That's what that prohibition was about. But in those days, the banks portfolioed their loans. So in Well, they kept them. They put them in their own vault and hold them and took the income.
For 30 years or whatever.
Well, or whatever.
So today, though, it's totally different.
Indeed, it's different. Originate to own market, where you originated a mortgage or a loan that your bank intended to keep. And so you were very careful. You used prudence and you knew who you were loaning money to. And then the market switched in the 80s to an originate to sell model, and this was after the Monetary Decontrol Act of 1980, which gave the Federal Reserve the power to monetize anything, not just treasury bills, bonds, and notes. So now there was an incentive to create this new level of security, and hence the creation of mortgage-backed securities, in which your mortgage might now be sold to 20 different banks, one right after the other. It might move through people's portfolio. So the idea that your mortgage was originated to hold versus your mortgage was originated to sell. And that's what the market is today. So when you go get a mortgage, the moment you sign that mortgage document, it may be sold to another bank or another investment consortium that you never, ever talked to when you were applying for the loan.
So today, though, they don't use other people's money to give you to build the house. That comes from monetization or...
Via the Federal Reserve.
Federal Reserve, right, where they create the money and then give you.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah, where the Federal Reserve monetizes a debt instrument. Yeah, so the bank effectively shows up at the Federal Reserve discount window and says, hey, I have this prime mortgage here from Patrick for $200,000. I'd like to borrow $200,000. Right. And so the Fed discounts that mortgage and loans them the money so that they can then loan it to you.
Oh, they loan them the money.
Sure.
At 0.25% or something. then they loan it to you at 4 or 5.
Correct.
I see. Yeah. That's pretty nice.
Just keep the spread, as they say.
Keep the spread. Patrick Timpone, Andrew Goss, and the Real World of Money. So now we'll dig into some more regular money news. Thanks for Andrew on the JFK thing. I hope you enjoy that. Give you a little update, and we'll do this. Daniel Vitalis, your pine pollen has been around for many years and really getting some good results with testosterone building for guys. How does it work?
Well, it works by actually containing phytotestosterone. It's very similar to when people use a bioidentical testosterone, except it's in a plant form and it's readily usable by the body. So many people have turned to bioidentical testosterone without looking to nature to see what options are out there. Pine pollen contains not only testosterone, but it's also got DHEA and a few other anabolic hormones as well. So if somebody's looking to increase the testosterone in their body and looking to have more anabolic function, then pine pollen is a really good alternative to some of the pharmaceutical therapies people have been turning to.
And so much easier on the body than the synthetic form. And we have pine pollen and all Surthrival links on sale right now, 10% off through November 7th. Promo code ONERADIO. Any Surthrival link right now. Click and order OneRadioNetwork.com.
There are a variety of programs on the One Radio Network, including The Real World of Money on Wednesdays between 9 and 11 Texas time. And it features Andy Goss and our company, SDL Incorporated. For those new listeners to the show, SDL Incorporated provides the best in American gold and silver coins to investors across the United States. If you'd like to become more familiar with the idea of working with American gold and silver coins as part of your investment portfolio, SDL Incorporated has provided some free information to investors and is now making available a set of three CDs at your request. Just by dialing this toll-free number, 1-800-468-2646.
It's Andrew Goss's company. Andrew, what do you think makes you, your company, unique among the late-night TV guys selling stuff? They're not selling numismatics, though, are they?
Well, they may be, just semi-numismatics.
But most of them are just as into bullion coins and things like that from the mint.
Yeah.
You know, like mint state, whatever.
Contrived numismatics.
Contrived. Yeah. But you sell real American money, St. Gaudens, and all these old coins.
Old coins.
All been graded. They're in plastic.
And it would do me no good to go on late-night television.
Well, you could, though. I mean, we could put you on Jimmy Kimmel or something.
Right, but last week we talked about a proof gold coin that I bought, an 1865 $3 gold piece, proof 61, one of 15 coins graded. It's a $40,000 piece, right? It's gone.
You sold it.
It's gone. So if I would have gone on late-night television with this coin, what could I have taken? One order? I mean, that's...
I understand.
It's the next time if you're a customer of this firm, and I've had this happen before, I offer somebody a coin, they go, yeah, you know what, I have a son and a daughter, I need two of those, so give me two. No, I have one. So most of the coins that, and I challenge you, other than a common semi-numismatic coin of St. Gaudens, if you're offered a rare coin by one of our brokers, ask him, okay, or her, all right, let me have a second example. You're done right there. We have one-of-a-kind coins in most instances, unless we buy a hoard or a stash. In reality, you know, that's the only coin, in my view, that's worth owning, is one that you can't buy in multiples. So if you can buy more than two or three of them, you don't want it. I mean, it's just that simple.
I've known Andrew over 20 years now, and he's the real deal, and he's not going to sell you something you don't want. But what can you offer people around the country that if they just want to kind of get into real American numismatic coins, whatever, a little bit every
education,
month.
Education, education. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you heard Fred on the commercial. People ask me what makes us different. Well, I have Fred. I have Donna. I have Gina. I have Roger. I have Tony. I have Mitchell. You know, all the crew here is what makes our company different from other companies. They all have a passion and a love for numismatics. And you ask them something, and probably the last thing you'll hear is, oh, I don't know. Let me go look it up. If it's something about a coin, when it was struck, how it was struck, what were the circumstances surrounding it, my staff, I would put their knowledge against any other coin staff in the world, not just the country. So these people have been with me for a very long time. They're tried and true. They would never do anything. One of my heroes is a man named Jim Blassingame, who is a small business advocate. And what he talks about, this is the age of the customer. The customer is the most important thing in your business. And we sure haven't forgotten that.
Well, in the day of the interweb and the mouse, too, I think real personal service from people that care, that's worth something, that's not going to go away.
So I think it's going to get stronger.
Yeah, sure.
As people want someone they can rely on. They don't want to hear, oh, this happened or that happened. You know, that there's a commercial on TV now. Wrong department. Let me put you on hold. And so, you know, people, that they just don't want that. They want personal service, and that's what we offer.
What's your phone number, sir?
800-468-2646. And mentioning Fred again, you know, his birthday is, guess what, November 22nd.
Oh, you're kidding.
Like me, he's also a scholar of the Kennedy assassination. And, you know, Fred, it's happy birthday month to you this first day of November. And I'm sure on the 22nd, it's one of those sad and happy days because we remember and we remember. So happy birthday month, Fred. 800-468-2646 if you're interested in learning more, get in touch with one of these crack numismatists here, and they'll teach you first and then supply you coins second.
His name is Andrew Goss, his company SDL. My name is Patrick Timpone. We have the Real World of Money live on One Radio Network every Wednesday morning, 9 to 11 o'clock. Sometimes we go longer than that with Andrew Goss, who's a currency historian, nationally recognized one of that. He has two books, Secret World of Money and Uncle Sam Cooks the Books. I think you can still get those books through Amazon. And also he's working on a third book, Monetary History of the United States. You heard a lot about how good maybe whey protein is to have in the morning with the kids or you have in the morning. I can do two scoops of that and you're getting 40 grams of protein. This is a really tremendous whey protein. We think it's one of the best ones out there. It is certified grass-fed whey, grass-fed cows rather, grass-fed moo cows. And that's a big deal. So you know you're getting the real, I mean, that's really what cows were meant to eat, you know that. Grass-fed cows for the whey. And they get it into the can at the lowest, lowest possible temperature that you can. They're not really allowed to call it raw because, well, if it's in a powder, you have to do something to it, and then you can't legally say it's raw. But it's as raw as you can get. Under the guidelines, 20 grams of protein per scoop. It will really kick up your glutathione levels a bunch, and that's because there's high cysteine levels and the sulfur-bearing amino acids in One World Whey. It's a great product. You can use it in between meals to put on some muscles before or after a workout, or use it as a meal replacement rather than maybe some complex carbs, you know, burrito, something like that, and you will lose weight that way with some good fats. Check it out on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com. Four flavors, chocolate, vanilla, strawberry, and unsweetened, unflavored, grass-fed One World Whey.
Know the source on One Radio Network.
It's the Real World of Money with Andrew Goss. Once again, here's Patrick.
And Andrew Goss on Wednesday, the 1st of November. Wow. Who'd have thunk it? Man, here we are. I mean, we're talking Thanksgiving and stuff and all that already.
I'm packing the car.
Where you going south, right?
Last night, Halloween, out there trick-or-treating with the grandkids.
Yep.
I was convinced. I turned to Cindy and said, you know, I'm going to have to take these flip-flops off. And by the way, Cindy's a big fan of One World Whey, so there's another endorsement there.
What
so,
flavor does she like?
The chocolate.
The chocolate, of course.
Who doesn't like chocolate?
Who doesn't like chocolate? Mm-hmm. Well, looks like, I guess, the word out this morning is that the new Fed chairman is who?
Jerome Powell.
Now, did he used to work for you know who?
No.
Oh,
well,
good.
Close.
who tells about Jerry Powell?
Oh, you know, he's a banker's trust guy.
So does he have swamp smell on him?
Well, let's put it this way. He co-founded Carlyle Group with George Bush and Du Bois. And you know Carlyle Group.
A little swampy there.
A bit of a swamp. And he's a known dove, meaning he's going to follow.
What's a dove mean?
He's going to follow the monetary policies of Janet Yellen. Well, a dove believes that we don't need to hike interest rates.
Huh.
And a hawk believes, oh gosh, we're creating so much money, we better do something or it's going to be worthless.
Oh, so he's a inflationist.
Yes, for lack of a better term, yes. He doesn't believe it's time for the Fed to raise interest rates. And in fact, you know, he is noteworthy in that belief. He also, shares other beliefs.
Yeah, so he's going to take over for Miss Yellen in February.
Yeah, after Mr. Cohn shot himself in the foot.
Gary Cohn was going to be the dude.
He was.
What did he do?
Well, if you recall when that whole Charlottesville thing broke.
Oh, yeah.
And the president said, well, there's bad actors on both sides of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so Cohn came out and said, how dare you defend those white supremacists.
There goes your plum of a job, dude.
There goes your job. Because You know, the boss just doesn't like to be criticized by his underlings.
You think?
I guess Cohn forgot who he was and where he was. You know, in his view, he's from Goldman Sachs, and he's going to be the next Fed chair, and everybody cares what he thinks. Well, this is one of those thoughts he should have just kept in his head. He might be getting his job as chairman of the Fed.
Well, I can only predict what the mainstream media is saying today. You know, it's a swamp guy because he's a banker. Well, yeah. Why would you...
He's a lawyer, actually.
Why would you... Oh, why would you not... promote a banker or a lawyer? I mean, a banker. He's not a banker. He's not a banker even. He's a lawyer.
Well, you know, he's not an economist. He's not a finance guy
so he's
like
not a geek.
Bernanke
yeah.
or even Janet Yellen. They're both academics and studied economics and finance, where this gentleman has only made a living in economics and finance.
I wonder if Mr. Trump likes him, right?
That's right. He's not an academic. He's a tried and true. And I think he'll be a good Fed choice, you know, given the pool out there. We could do a lot worse than Jerome Powell.
Well, at least we bypassed Golda Meir Slacks for one appointment, right?
For a minute.
Only for a minute. Yeah. But this zero interest rates that have been going on for a long time, or very low interest rates, you've taught us over the years that this has been really not a good thing. This is foisted malinvestments.
Yes.
This is the reason why the stock market's at 24,000, right?
Yep.
All this cheap money, the sloshing around.
Yes, indeed. And
so
boy,
he's going to do more of it.
Yeah.
So what does that mean for gold?
Well, he's not going to be as quick to choke it down.
Yeah.
Well, gold and silver is in a unique position that regardless of what they do, it's going to benefit. It's going to benefit more from an inflationary stance and maybe less from a hawkish stance. But either one is good for gold. And if you look at the lead metals, the metals that kind of lead things, the industrial metals, the zinc and nickel and copper, have all started on a tear. So the commodities in general will lead the price, these so-called industrial commodities. And then remember, gold being a monetary metal, that one will probably follow the industrial metals.
Dollar's up today, gold's up today, silver's up today, everybody's happy. Market's
dollar's up
today.
And gold's up, yeah. That's never good.
Yeah, well, why?
Well, because when the dollar's up, gold is supposed to go down.
Right.
So when the dollar goes up and gold goes
up,
that shows you it's an unnatural move. So I fully expect that that gold will rally from here. I'm still on track for end of year around 1400. And I think we'll definitely see some significant growth in gold in 2018.
What about silver? You know, the silver bugs have been out there for a year waiting for the big hit. And just doesn't want to seem to do much. $17, pretty cheap for an ounce of silver, right?
Yeah, seems to me very cheap. You know, I think back a couple decades ago, though, and that goes by pretty fast, when silver was still in the sub $7 range. So at $17, it does seem like, I mean, even if you just bought it in 1997, and just held it for 20 years, you would have tripled your money, maybe quadrupled it. So the idea of buying it today and selling it tomorrow in any of these coins or in the precious metals, in my opinion, that's not a good strategy. You should be stacking, buying, accumulating.
Stack them up.
Stack them up. And in periods when you have a lull in prices, don't back off. No matter what you're averaging into, you know, at the time when everyone else is down on your investment, that's the time where you have to buck up and have the fortitude to add to your portfolio. And what typically happens is, you know, if you had been buying silver, let's say between 21 and 45, where it's been for the last 5 years, then you're looking at it now and saying, well, all this silver I bought at $30 and $25, and now it's 17, I'm just going to stop buying. Big mistake. You need to average that position down. So, you know, if you bought at 20 or 25 or 30 or 35, you really need to be doubling up now when it's 17, because it's not going to stay here for very long.
If you'd like to ask Andrew a question or a comment, we have two ways to do it. 888-663-6386 email, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. I can remember back in 1790, Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, Treasury Secretary, in his first report to the public, he said, he put forth the concepts of assumption and redemption.
Mm-hmm.
He argued that the federal government should assume the Revolutionary War debt
all the state
other states
debts.
And pay those debts at face value.
That's right.
In full to the bearers of such debt on demand in order to redeem $75 million of bonds. Hamilton promoted creation of a sinking fund that would pay off the 5% bonds annually. Wow. Pretty fun.
Well, this was after he and his agents and, of course, Philip Schuyler, his father-in-law and a bigwig up in New York, had sent forth his agents to buy all of this debt. So they had managed to amass the great majority of it. Mm. And prior to that suggestion, you know, the idea was, oh, this debt is no good. Nobody's going to. So they were buying it for literally pennies on the dollar. And once they had accumulated the lion's share of this debt, these debt instruments.
Then they had the government
then,
full face value.
That's right.
Those rascals.
This is the very same thing that was done during the mortgage-backed security crisis, if you recall.
Sure.
When Merrill Lynch packed up its bags and moved west, they sold famously their entire mortgage-backed securities portfolio for 30 cents on the dollar. And the buyer, none other than J.P. Morgan and Company, J.P. Morgan Chase, knew, obviously, that the mortgage-backed securities would be taken off the market by the Federal Reserve at full face value.
So they bought it at 30 cents, J.P.
And sold it immediately for $1.
Because they knew what was going on.
That's right.
Because
they're part owners of the Fed. Yeah, that perfect information.
That's so, not inside trading?
Well, who's going to find the smoking gun there?
Yeah. Yep. Wow. And then didn't Warren
even
Buffett
though,
do
even
a deal
though
like
one
that?
Of one of the traders, yes, of course, famously with Solomon Brothers, but one of the traders was actually busted for leaving the Federal Reserve meeting and calling his friends. Right? I mean, that happened. That's not conjecture. The guy was charged with it because he actually left the meeting and called his buddy and said, "Hey, guess what we're going to do?" And so, you know, that sort of thing is the insider trading that these folks capitalize on and trade on. Makes me want to go back to the Nixon timeline.
They put Martha in a bracelet.
Put her in a suit, yeah.
Put her a suit around her ankle and lock her in her kitchen for a year, Martha Stewart.
Right.
Give me a break.
But they get away with that sort of thing.